Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Today, Sean Kiernan, CEO of Green Gauge, is in conversation with Tim Grant, head of EMEA at Galaxy Digital. Both Galaxy and Green Gauge aim to participate in the digital merchant banking space, but each is approaching this from a different angle. Tim and Sean discuss how to define merchant banking and what elements of this historic tradition are possible to bring back today. They also look at where the institutional crypto market is heading, the benefits of tokenization, and the future of Web3, and they ask whether the metaverse is really ready yet for corporate engagement.
Tim, it's a real pleasure to have you here. You're a big guy in the crypto space, running Galaxy outside of the US.
Yeah, give or take, EMEA, technically.
Which is a pretty big deal indeed. And I think both Green Gauge and Galaxy are known, and if you Google search us, as digital merchant banks, obviously doing very different things. But it'd be great to hear your take on what merchant banking is and how our space can help maybe bring it back to life.
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. I'm not sure how big a guy I am, but one works hard to allow yourself to be the right presence in the industry. You know, it's a great question because ever since I started thinking about working for Galaxy, this term merchant banking kept coming up, and it's very appealing actually in a bit of an old school British merchant banking kind of, I'm a merchant banker kind of way. And actually, I've never stopped to think about what that really means. And so the question is good for that reason. So it's interesting. If you look at merchant banking versus investment banking, that tends to be the differentiate, well, retail banking. We could go down a big rabbit hole on this one and go to Wikipedia and get some definitions. But I think the simplest distillation of what merchant banking is, that there's an element of investing off the balance sheet. So that's the way we think about it. So if I describe in brief Galaxy's business model, we have a classic sales and trading operation. We have a classic investment banking, i.e. corporate finance, M&A and advisory business. We have a mining business where we do Bitcoin mining, so we're a commodities producer of sorts. We have a venture investing business where we invest off of the balance sheet, and we've done quite a lot. It's a pretty significant billion-plus portfolio. And then you've got the asset management business, which is external money, and we manage that in different ways. I think why we've often used that term merchant banking, because it does hark back to that Goldman's, Morgan Stanley sort of partner model that used to exist in the 70s and 80s and got phased out towards the tail end of the 90s as some of them went public and regulation came in and segmented the sorts of things you can do. But in some respects, this new world that we're in, this digital asset medium in this digital asset world, does allow for us to redefine and redraw some of those lines. We don't need to be shackled. As long as we're not doing anything illegal, we don't need to be shackled by those definitions. So I think for us, the value prop for our clients, if you turn it around to that, is we're not only partnering with you on giving you services and giving you liquidity or managing your assets for you, but we're investing. We may invest alongside you. Because we're an investor, we're probably going to give you better advice as you want to raise money. And I think that's the essence of it. It's that, like, we are a merchant banker. We're taking capital risk ourselves to understand. So we always talk about mining as, yes, we want to mine because it's a profitable business to mine in its own right. But we also want to mine because we're going to be a much better provider of services to the mining industry if we're mining. And I think that sort of maybe captures the essence of merchant banking. What's interesting, though, is how this is going to evolve, because there is almost an inevitability to some of those lines eventually being drawn and codified by regulation, that maybe we have to not do some things and other things, and principal risk versus agency risk and all of that. And so maybe the term won't be relevant one day, but for now, I think that's a good definition of how we do it.
It's very interesting way you frame it. I'm also sitting on the same side of the table as your clients, getting to understand how they tick. Galaxy is obviously very well known in our industry for having, as you listed very well, the various services, but I think particularly liquidity management, treasury, structured products. It'd be great to get your thoughts on where you see the direction of travel for players like Galaxy, but the broader industry in terms of these new products coming online, and where your focus is as a business.
because we have all of those businesses I described, and by the way, I shouldn't do our new colleagues a disservice. We literally just announced today that we've closed the transaction of the acquisition of GK8. So hello out there to our new, brand new colleagues in our new Tel Aviv office. We have 40 plus new Galaxy employees. It's super exciting to have them. And what they're doing is building a custody backend that's really differentiated. It's like a really strong cold storage solution. And they also have a tokenization stack, which kind of brings us into a whole new area. Now, that's six total businesses I rhymed off in the last sort of few minutes. Now, that's a lot. We do a lot. And it's actually interesting, by the way, you reacted to my comment. You like, we're sitting on the same side as the client. It's like, therein lies the sort of the potential conflict that we've got to be really careful about. And so we do take that very seriously, but it's an interesting observation. So I'm going to focus, though, on the market making and the spot derivatives lending prime side of our business. That's our global markets business. And it's actually very top of mind where that's going and what's going to happen to that market. You know, we've seen all of these booms and busts in crypto, the famous four-year cycle, which apparently seems to be very consistent. And every time you go through one of those cycles, you end up having new players with a slightly different complexion to how they look at risk and how they invest. And then, and you've got the evolution of regulation, which depending on where you're sitting in the world is either good or bad at a given moment. And so where are we now in that evolution? I think what's interesting is we sensed at the end of 2022, because of the relative turmoil we saw, obviously ending in the calamity that is FTX. And a lot of the institutional players, because at the end of the day, Sean, we know that real momentum and evolution in this space is going to happen when large amounts of institutional capital come through the door. Like that, that just is how this is going to evolve, or rather, that's the most effective way for the industry to grow. The change that we've seen as the tail end of last year is this sort of reaction to FTX was often, oh, not crypto, but tokenization. And actually, you can probably find most big CEOs, certainly Larry Fink and Jamie Dimon, for sure, because I've, you know, seen them myself, but a lot of them saying out loud something like that. No, not this crypto stuff, but actually did tokenization and digital assets. But actually, I'll call that was a little bit of an opportunist set of comments, because we don't see any lack of institutional adoption momentum in the background for crypto. It might be a bit delayed. There may be a little bit of, oh, I'll just take a moment and I'll let this die down. But it is that, not, right, I'm out. Because if you were looking into that beforehand, it's going to take more if you understand the space and you know for a fact that FTX was really about fraud and not about the underlying assets, then actually you know that you're still in it to win it and you still have a trajectory to go and you're still getting your clients asking you to get involved in some way. So that's the theme that we hear. So what does that all mean for where we go from here? It's the, for us, we're highly focused on A, continuing to service our rapidly consolidating crypto native fund client base. It's interesting, if you look at the statistics, which we have from our vision track, more than 1,500 funds that we track. And so we have a good sense of that fund community. It's consolidating, as you would expect. A bunch of people got knocked out. Galois is the latest one that we heard on in the news a few days ago. I'm sure we'll see more. So, but that community still needs to be serviced, and they're becoming more sophisticated. They're becoming more institutional, is really what's happening. So they'll continue to grow, but really, and consolidate but grow. But really the interesting part is, what about the banks? What about the asset managers? What about the sovereign wealth funds? And by the way, I'd put the high net worths and the family offices in that original category. They'll continue to get involved in. But what about wealth management franchises? Like, they're the next frontier of large pools of institutional capital that are waiting to get in. And so the theme is, how do you service them? How do we leverage regulation, which I think we embrace, to give you and your customers the comfort to engage? And perversely, you have to provide it in a bit of a TradFi wrapper for them to take it. But that's okay. I think we need to be okay with that as a step. Once they're starting to take that risk, then we start to introduce all the other elements, the beautiful elements of blockchain that will give us extraordinary efficiencies and a faster, better, cheaper system for the future. So that theme of institutional adoption and institutionalization, the market's moving at pace. and seeing the service providers grow up. You're seeing the trading community grow up. You're seeing the intermediaries that come up growing up and creating a more secure outcome, a more secure infrastructure. And it's exciting, even though we've just had a really rough year. And it's probably going to be a bit of a so-so 2023 until the macroeconomic backdrop bumps. It's exciting because what we know, and we saw a little bit of it in January, because we had a little taster when January had like that crypto rally. As soon as you start, it's so wonderfully reflexive and so beautifully like predictable that as soon as price action starts to go up, you start to see everybody pile in. It is the most psychologically like, yep, that's how that works. That's just how psychology works. More than ever in any of those cycles, the institutional money's primed to get in because it has means and ways to get in. And so we at Galaxy, we're a very B2B franchise. We're a very institutionally focused franchise. And the way I say it's top down. We're trying to go to the biggest financial institutions in the world and work our way through to service them. We can sense it. So it's all about timing and all about the macro. But hopefully that gives you a sense of what we're thinking.
Very. It's fascinating to see the institutionalization of the market. You mentioned consolidation as a play, but also that the outstanding players are also getting more sophisticated. What role do you think structured products particularly are playing to help attract or maybe bring people into the space, if at all?
I think structured products, and I may be horrifically wrong on this a few years from now, but it's going to take a few years for it to find out, in which case I'll be long gone. But I'll go on record, I've said this before, I think structured products is one of the big frontiers that will allow adoption to happen. Firstly, let's quickly define a structured product. A structured product, because it can have multiple definitions about it. When we're talking about it here, what we're talking about is the ability to buy a bankable security that has an ISIN, just like a bond, and then you put it into your portfolio, be that an institutional portfolio or a wealth management portfolio, asset management maybe, private banking. And that embedded in that ISIN and in that structure is a payoff. It's some sort of bet, some sort of belief in what's going to happen to an underlying. And there's a huge multi-trillion dollar structured products market that has been functioning for decades that services primarily that wealth management private banking community, and that is trillions of dollars of capital. Just look at UBS, that I think something like 3 trillion, just them, they're the biggest one. A lot of capital, and there are big revenues to be made on the sell side by banks by that. It in many respects drives a lot of flow from the derivatives market. So the growth of the derivatives market is really important here. And we are seeing that in crypto. And we think we're the biggest balance sheet in the crypto derivatives market in the world. So in theory, we are really well placed to become that sort of underlying hedge, as it were, for those structured products. But the thing is, until now, we've only seen on the margin at best crypto-backed structured products land. There are some players out there who are doing it. We've been doing it as well on the margin. We'll do it for high net worths and we'll do it bilaterally. But really, the nut we have to crack is distribution mechanism into all of that at that private wealth, because they're the guys buying this stuff. So it's actually extraordinary it hasn't happened. But then you think about it and you're like, well, I guess it makes sense, because if the gatekeepers to those clients are big institutional players, then they've been quite nervous about engaging with crypto. And they certainly can't, for the most part, have crypto on their balance sheet because of the onerous implications of that, be it regulatory or capital or both. So, all right, I suppose that does make sense that hasn't happened. But you can be 100% sure, if you talk offline to any wealth management head around the world, they've been getting asked for this for years, for the very reason that we talked about before, like that as soon as you get any kind of price action, who are the fastest to move? It's the wealthy individuals who made money doing that in the first place, right? They will phone up their banker and say, all right, I want to go long Bitcoin, or I want to go long Bitcoin with capital protection, or I want yield enhancement. And there's loads of ways to do that. And there's no mystery that of how you structure products. That's been around for a long time. Lots of people doing that. So the demand side of the equation is there. What I think as part of that trend that I discussed before about the institutionalization of the market is you're starting to see the line of sight to that distribution mechanism opening up. We're really excited. We're talking to some really genuinely large, important wealth management banking partners to help us crack that open. And that's a 2023 event, not a 2024 event. So that's exciting. But my sense is as soon as we get those pipes flushed and we start to see wealthy individuals and wealth management clients being able to buy that risk and put it in their portfolios, and these are generally shorter term, can be 2 weeks, can be 2 months, can be a few months maximum, but they tend to be short-term payoffs. And that bump, that natural psychological, I want a piece of the action reaction, then you'll see that explode. And it needed the crypto derivatives market to be functioning sufficiently for the hedges to be able to be there. And we can tell you with certainty that the volumes in the Bitcoin and ETH derivatives markets are more than enough to be able to support that. And actually in some other coins as well. And then we'll get into more exotic payoffs, and that will sort of drive demand for more exotic derivative structures to be traded. And that's all super healthy. And then that contributes to the growth of the derivatives market, which in any market tends to end up being larger by multiples of the spot market. And now we're talking about an institutional market. We're not talking about a retail market anymore. It's all part of the same theme. And I think I've had this conversation years ago, but it was never quite right. The pieces of the puzzle were never quite there. Now, here we are at the beginning of 2023, when the regulatory appetite or the regulatory clarity, the liquidity of the derivatives market, the demand side of the equation, the evolution of thinking in these big institutional players has gone from absolutely not to, well, okay, let's dip our toes into this and finally see if we can satisfy demand. And one last point to make on this is, like, you know for a fact that most of the people who wanted that risk went and found it somewhere else. That's the truth of the matter. That if I'm a wealthy individual and I've got all my money with a big wealth manager, and I phone up and I say, hey, can I buy Bitcoin? And they're like, nope, not in a snowball chance in hell are you going to make it. Never mind, can I have a complex payoff structure on Bitcoin options and a structured product? That they went somewhere else. And that usually meant they had to go to something unregulated, offshore. And that isn't that what, to some extent, we want to avoid, like, as a core principle. We want to bring it all within the regulatory perimeter, because that's just smart. Like, that's good for everybody. So it all was part of this sort of big momentum theme. And it's not a case of if, it's really a case of when. So that's why I think this structured products thing is important. And I personally, I'm super excited about it and on a bit of a mission.
That sounds great. I never thought normalization would be so exciting, but to see the industry grow up. You've already mentioned tokenization as a trend or comment from some of the big CEOs of big banks. We've talked about this a little bit in terms of tokenization, not necessarily meaning extra liquidity, although the transformation of the infrastructure might be more efficient. What are your thoughts on tokenization as a broader trend?
Right. So I'm also fascinated by tokenization. I came out of TradFi in 2015, where I was working at UBS's hedge fund unit, and ended up at R3, which is the software blockchain consortium driven by financial services. And back at the time, I was the CEO of the lab at R3, and we had like 40, I think we started with 42 banks when I started. And then by the time I left, a couple of years later, we had like over 100 global financial institutions in this lab. And it was one of those moments in time that will be hard to repeat, because you have all these players who kind of, in a funny way, on the back of, you know, this Bitcoin had been around obviously for a while, but then Ethereum came on and really captured everybody's attention, this sort of smart contract, programmable nature kind of feature suddenly captured everyone's attention. And all of a sudden you've got the biggest institutions in the world and the regulators and the central banks. And so they all got together and they all paid money into this thing and they all wanted to test stuff. And so I was the, frankly, well-placed, lucky individual who was like, literally told to be like, right, go and figure out what to do with them to test what we're going to do with this new technology. It was very cool. And it was very early in the game, late 2015. What was really going on? Now, the reason I tell that story is because that's when tokenization was, I remember in the very first conversations with the group, like, everyone's like, should we tokenize bonds? Because there's a really intuitive reason to want to tokenize bonds. Like, if you can represent a bond as a token within a smart contract, and you can manage the life cycle of that bond on chain, public or private, let's not debate that, and you can allow delivery versus payment of the asset versus the cash leg to be done in tokenized manner, you can get to what I call T plus minimum viable X, T plus MVX, which is just minimum viable settlement time. In all of that, what I just described was a much faster, better, cheaper, less capital intensive and lower fees at all points in the cycle solution. And it's kind of obvious. And it was back then. Okay, that's the end of 2015. Where are we now? You might argue we're exactly nowhere. You might argue like, no, but the bond markets still function precisely the way they did before. And I'm just going to use bonds as an example, but to be clear, you can tokenize anything. You can tokenize equities, you can tokenize structured products, you can tokenize funds, you can tokenize physical objects. So everything can be tokenized and represented in this way. But I'm just going to stick with bonds because I just find it to be the more obvious one to go for. So you've had a very long journey. Why is it taking so long? Why have we gotten to the beginning of 2023? And yes, you've got Six Digital Exchange, which I used to run high to all my former colleagues at Six Digital Exchange, who've built a regulated exchange and CSD for digital assets in Switzerland. And you've got other venues. You've got Archax in the UK, which has done something similar. And you've got other venues around the world. And then you've got regulatory clarity in some jurisdictions about what it means to issue and represent a bond on chain that actually makes it quite straightforward. And then you've got, you know, issuers that want to do it. The European Investment Bank, the EIB, has done two big issuances. You've got banks like Goldman's and Santander and SocGen supporting those. And you've got, therefore, buy side buying some of those. But you know, UBS did a big issuance on SDX. It was 385 million Swiss francs. And the list can go on of examples like KKR's recent tokenization of a fund, right? The list goes on. None of that, in some respects, and I don't want to pour cold water over any of those efforts at all, many of which I was involved in one way or another, it doesn't create a minimum viable, I'm going to keep using that term because it's just one of my favorite, like a minimum viable digital capital market. It doesn't get us to the place where from the issuance to the asset being in a portfolio to its life cycle and its redemption, that it's all done on chain and it delivers the promise of the obvious thing we knew back in 2015. And so we're at this very interesting moment a bit, and it's sort of a bit like the structured product story where all the pieces of the puzzle are finally starting to come together. You've got the institution, and now this is when the comments that were made at the tail end of last year by Larry Fink and Jamie Dimon and everybody else are super relevant. They believe in tokenization. I think Jamie Dimon, not long after he just had a massive go at Bitcoin and has been sharply rebuked as a result by us in the industry, like that was a bit misguided, old boy. But you then followed up with a smart comment about tokenization and the fact that they're doing tokenized repo intraday already. Great. That's a pretty meaningful statement that this is in production, albeit within one closed wall, which is JP Morgan, but that's a good progress. They're saying that because the collective consciousness has reached this moment of, I think, no return. I think there's an inevitability to the fact that tokenization and digital capital markets are going to be a reality. And that seems to have only just happened, and in many respects might have, as I mentioned earlier, been exacerbated by the FTX thing. Oh, we'll just focus all of our digital asset attention on tokenization. Hey, we'll take it. Now, combined with the fact that a lot of pieces of infrastructure, because remember, in order to get this right, what we need venues, we need to understand how we're going to do margining, we need to understand how we're going to do collateral in the digital world and repo, settlement, representation of cash, all of that needs to be resolved. And we've got projects that have been around since for many years now, starting to come to fruition. And many people don't really know about this. It's sort of one of a quiet, almost a sleepy backwater. But you've got Finality. And Finality is working with the UK government, the UK Central Bank, the America, the Fed, and the ECB to create a form of tokenized fiat. And it's quite an elegant solution and could be the answer for the cash leg. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. We've got venues, both centralized and decentralized, starting to come up. You've got Fintium, which is a great project, which is looking at FX and intraday lending. You've got R3 and Consensus, who are starting to realize that you can't build walled gardens. This is a network of networks. And these realizations are really meaningful. Like there's a place for everybody in all of this. And so the distance from here to minimum viable digital capital market is starting to shrink fast. So I think the promise of tokenization, I did say publicly years ago, I think literally as far back as 2016, like I called the death of the POC, the death of the proof of concept. I was a bit early on that one, as it turned out. actually, it turns out we're still doing proof of concepts. Look, I'm not going to be too negative about proof of concepts because I do recognize their value. However, we do need to move beyond proof of concepts and we need to get to what I'll call lighthouse projects. So lighthouse projects, I love that term. It's got to be a project that isn't proving a concept, fundamentally proven. It's actually, where are we going from here? How do we get to that minimum viable capital market? What projects can we do that really bring the whole industry along? The last point I'll make on tokenization is that traditionally evolution has been driven by the sell side. Sell side arguably had more money, was more nimble, and just had the aptitude to think about innovation in a different way and made decisions to do that. And actually it was more relevant and more of a merchant banking model. Now it's not quite that way. The banks don't have the capital. Just look at bond trading desks. I grew up in the bond market. That's partly why I'm banging on about bonds. Bond trading desks have dramatically smaller inventory than they did years ago. Pre-crisis, they had tons. And it's just, there's this extraordinary graphs that you can see where it just shrunk. They don't have the capital. They don't have the bonds anymore. Who has the bonds? The asset owners. The asset owners are the people who are in the strong position to influence where we go from here. And they need to kind of step up to the plate. And I think they are. And no, that's Larry Fink saying that out loud, right? The biggest asset manager in the world. So I think it's going to be an interesting new dynamic where the asset owners are pushing. No, I want to tokenize my bonds. Why would I want to tokenize my bonds? Well, because it's going to be faster, better, cheaper. That's better for me and better for my clients. Surely that's better. Who's it not better for? The incumbent debt capital markets businesses on the sell side. They don't like it. I'll spare you some of my stories about inevitability of the inertia of the traditional incumbents. But they're just going to do that. In some respects, it's rational. I'll just keep on these big fee structures for as long as possible. But for the issuers and the asset owners, it only makes sense if that fee structure starts to be compressed. So who's incentivized? Everyone except the person that's charging the fees today. And there are other intermediaries who are just going to get knocked out of all of this. But we've never been so close to that outcome, which is exciting. It's still going to require time. And I focused on bonds, but this has material kind of knock-on and very positive effects. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, to bring it back to something that matters to every one of us. If capital raising in general for businesses, and debt is just one example, has a certain fee structure, it blended globally, and you can reduce that by a few percentage points, and you also reduce the capital tied up in moving these things around, the net effect on the global economy is actually something meaningful. It does actually move the needle. When you're talking about hundreds of trillions of assets, I once stood in front of Ethereal in 2018 or 19 in a kilt, I'll hasten to add, and gave a talk where the slide behind me had the size of the crypto market, the size of the debt market, the equity market, the derivatives market. It's like when crypto market, as valuable I think it is as a genuine asset class to invest in, pales in comparison to the traditional asset markets. And we're not even talking about real estate. Tokenize that lot. Now we're talking. Now we're talking about real effect. And that is exciting.
It's great to hear. I mean, you thought about this a lot. And the idea of tipping points, we've talked about structured products and now tokenization. One area we hear a lot about is Web3 or the metaverse, perhaps an expression of that. Are you sold on these concepts? Do you think that they're at a similar stage or are they something else?
Am I sold? Yes. I think you have to be doing my job and to be in this industry, you have to believe in it. So the metaverse is a bit like merchant banking. It's like, what does it really mean? So if we just choose to define it as metaverse, Web3, some people hate the term Web3 and some people hate the term metaverse. I don't really have strong feelings. Let's just put our cards on the table at the beginning. Say it's everything that's the intersection of gaming, blockchain infrastructure, and digital assets as a whole, crypto and non-crypto tokenization included, and experiential XR, I suppose they're calling it these days, right? Augmented reality and virtual reality, like this sort of the intersection of all of that and entertainment. We've also passed the point, I think, and arguably, if you look at, I mean, just look at Facebook and what it renamed itself, and I'll spare commentary on that, but like, this is happening. There is more investment going in to sort of metaverse gaming and metaverse enablement than people think. We have a fund called the Galaxy Interactive Fund run by my friends Sam and Richard, we're running hundreds of millions of capital on this. And just look at how quickly the big players in Silicon Valley were able to raise money last year on the back of this sort of in the click of a finger and they've got billions. This is being invested in, and it's not like everyone's got this mirage. Like if you've been through Web 2, it's not difficult to predict what's going to happen. So I'm sold on it. The part that's worth drilling down on is digital assets, the digital asset element of it. And I always go back to, I was actually just reading on the way over that BlackRock has just done a metaverse ETF. Now, they're not the first. I think there's a few others, but big deal that BlackRock's decided to do a metaverse ETF. And what does it include? Well, it includes Meta, includes Nvidia graphics cards and stuff like that. It includes Roblox, right? And then right there, you've got, okay, that's how people are expressing the future of the metaverse. I remember being back during the pandemic one morning at breakfast, and my son said, what's an NFT, Daddy? And I remember thinking, it's going to be a long one, this one, right? All right, how do I do it? You know what? It took a minute, because the idea of a digital object and a digitized means of exchange of value, I'm not even going to say payment, exchange of value, is totally native to my then 8-year-old. Like, wow, we still have to labor this one at our age. The reality is that our children are growing up with utterly conditioned that this is going to be the way that they engage in the world around them. So the demand side of the equation is literally at school, or I don't know where you could draw the line, but the demand side of the equation is there. So it's totally inevitable, but digital assets, that's an NFT. Digital objects in a game, that's a digital asset. The means of payment, literally, whether it be it's a tokenized dollars or if it be some token that's relevant to a game, it's still a tokenized asset. It's all the same thing. So what's exciting is the sort of the breakdown of the walled gardens. A very smart man once told me value is created at the intersection of previously walled gardens. I haven't said that in a while. That's a good one, right? Value is created at the intersection of previously walled gardens. Apply that to the bond market thing we were talking about, and apply that to the intersection of gaming, all the things I listed before that we might call the metaverse. It's the same concept: faster, better, cheaper, more exciting. And when it's the experiential stuff, it's like, wow, I'm getting an experience that I've never gotten before. And we're going to lean into that. Ready Player One, the movie. That will prove to be one day highly prescient, I imagine. So yeah, we're all about that. And we invest in metaverse related companies. We service them, we help them capital raise, we trade with them. It's a big deal. It's not my specialism, but it's going to be exciting to see 10 years from now what cool stuff has been thought up using all of those tools. I can't wait. Can't wait to spend my hard-earned tokens on it.
Fantastic. I was very keen to get your thoughts on some of the bad apples, so to speak, and what we as an industry can do. I think these tipping points are driven by trends, so to speak. And if we have some players that might interrupt the trend by maybe behaving outside of acceptable norms, what do you think we can do as participants at Galaxy, Greengage, others that are listening to improve the esprit de corps?
It's the right question, isn't it? Like the story, which can't wait to see the story that's written by Michael Lewis, who allegedly was embedded with SBF, with Sam Bankman-Fried, in the 9 months leading to the calamity. I can't wait to read that book and watch that movie. And it will go down in history, I think, as one of the most incredible, like, volte-face all the way from the darling of everybody to the one everybody loves to hate, including me, because he just broke the cardinal rule. He BS'd his way to the top and he kind of ruined the party for everybody in a way that didn't need to happen. But cautionary tales like that have a way of becoming some level of salvation. So yeah, we can't, the reason regulation exists is because you can't trust everybody. Like there's no way around that. You tried to move money on your personal retail bank app recently, and how many times does it say, are you sure? You're probably getting scammed. I wouldn't do this if I were you, but if you're really sure, press here. And you're like, yeah, no, I'm totally sure. I know who the person is. No, we're going to double check. And it's kind of amazing. Now, why would that be there? Why had that suddenly appeared over the last few years? Because the volume of fraud going on in that area, which is utterly TradFi, is mind-boggling. It's just not the headline anymore. It's like anything in this modern world. It's been going on for so long and it's so big, we're just bored. It's not a news item anymore. So there's an inevitability to bad actors. But you're right. the thrust of your question is we're supposed to do something about this. So A, you're supposed to lean into regulation. We are supposed to work with the regulators, and the regulators are supposed to work with us to generate as fast as possible clear guidelines that don't throttle innovation and allow us to launch into this in a safe way. Will that get rid of it? No. But that's what one of the things we're supposed to do. I actually had to talk in front of the UK Treasury Select Committee. It was pre-arranged, but it was the Monday after FTX. And so that's all on record online. If one's really bored, one can go find it. But that, of course, that it all ended up being about FTX the whole time. And I said at the time, like, after we tried to define the this is a bad actor, which wasn't so obvious the Monday after FTX, but really is now. Like, this is a, we knew though, it's a bad actor. When you've got past that point, you're like, what it means is, and I'm talking to you, UK Treasury Select Committee, and I want you to help us and the Treasury and the FCA to lean into this. We want, I'm begging you for better clarification on regulation. So that's number one, regulation, more of it. Number two, self-regulation. So I don't, there's been some chatter on this and I don't quite know where it goes, but there is the notion of an SRO. In theory, we're supposed to do some self-policing here. We're supposed to be grown-ups and we're supposed to root out our own bad actors and not wait for the law and the regulation to find it for us. So self-regulation, industry organization, and talking more about it, which is why I really welcome this question. Right, let's talk about this, because it's a moral question and what we should be rooted in morality if we're doing all of this. So self-regulation is important. And then there's a very personal element to it. Firstly, let's all be good out there, kids, right? That's a bit trite. But there is an element of, if you happen to find yourself in a company where you're like, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right, then we're supposed to vote with our feet. We're supposed to vote with our voices and we're supposed to do something about it, not just be there. Now, who in FTX really knew? It would appear practically nobody. So I'm not going to call out a lot of those victims because they probably were too. So sometimes there's nothing to see because it's so well hidden, but often it's there, often you know. So just don't do it. So just be a voice for good. It will be better for everyone. I think that's the sort of the, oh, and if we see people doing it, we're supposed to call it out. So isn't that kind of the essence of rooting out bad actors and shining a light on them and making sure people get punished for stuff? I do hope SBF gets really punished for this. He should be the poster child for not being a bad boy. I think somewhere in there, there's the path to redemption.
One would hope.
One would hope.
Yes. I like how you frame this in terms of almost my word is my bond,
yeah.
which goes back also to the days of classic merchant banks.
Yeah.
I'm mindful of your time. You've been very generous. But I have one final question, which is looking at the UK and the international climate for attracting these new firms and technologies to base in a particular jurisdiction. What are your thoughts on where the UK is versus others and where are you bullish?
It is always fascinating to watch the ebbs and flows of jurisdictions. And the fact that you can see it on a time frame that isn't years is even more fascinating. Good old fashioned regulation is just sort of, it's been done. It's been, you have to keep evolving all the time and new products and stuff in traditional finance, but it's well known in there. Here you've got 1 minute China has banned all crypto and mining on its shores. And the next minute, well, it's changed its mind and it's going to let Hong Kong get stuck in there. And these are like seismic shifts. 1 minute you think that the US is sort of on the right trajectory. And then it would appear that Gary Gensler and his SEC are on some sort of vendetta of some sort. Sometimes if you look at what they're doing and what you're hearing and seeing out in the US is definitely less positive. It's not so obvious for people to plan to do business in the US. And then you come over to Europe and actually you've gone from 2 years ago, the common view was that in the UK, the FCA was negative and anti, and they did put in place some regulation that was distinctly prohibitive, and that Europe was so slow that it was never going to get there. Now Europe's on the cusp of putting MiCA markets in crypto assets regulation. Once it's been translated into the 400 languages it needs to be translated into, they'll finally get to pushing it through and coming up with the stuff. But it's like, it's going to happen. It's a matter of time now. There's an inevitability to that, which is great. And so suddenly you can kind of plan to do business in Europe. And at some point there will be regulation across the entirety of the EU bloc, which allows people to do business. Now the UK I think this really extraordinary opportunity to get it bang on right. While the US is in a more challenging place for this, and I do think it's just a matter of time that they pass it out, work it through and get it right. You've got the UK, which the firing gun, the gun was fired last April 2022, when at the time when Rishi Sunak was Chancellor of the Exchequer, said that we want to be a crypto hub in the UK. And here we are less than a year later, and only a couple of weeks ago, we got more clarification from the UK about where it's going with regulation. And the real headline there is, we're not going to do a MiCA and a Europe and come up with separate regulation. We're just going to assess this as another asset class, and we're going to include it in the world-class regulatory kind of regime that we have, which many other ones are based on. So it's got a knock-on effect, which is a big brother element to UK's regulation, rightly so. And there's more wood to chop, but that's a really good sign for the UK. That's a very productive sign. And when you look at things like ETFs, it's a great example of a very specific product that allows lots of people in a regulated framework to get access to a particular kind of risk. The two big holdouts in the globe are the two biggest ETF markets. It's the UK and the US. So the UK has an opportunity to, with minor tweaks from the FCA, allow really big institutional regulated entities to create an example, a Bitcoin-backed ETF / ETP / ETN, depending on the definition, and give, within the regulatory perimeter, everybody the ability to invest in this asset class without having to go to all the venues that the regulators don't like because they're unregulated. It's right there in front of us. And let's hope that the momentum continues. Our engagements with His Majesty's Treasury and the FCA have been productive. And I think I know that's true of lots of people will say that who engage with them. We're in a really unique position in the UK to actually become that UK hub. And if you look back at everything we've talked about, the evolution of financial markets, the evolution of metaverse and everything that it touches, wouldn't you want the UK to be at the forefront of that on a 10 to 20 year horizon? Yeah, you would. Like, that's not even, you don't even need an economics degree to figure that one out. So it is a good moment, I think. We don't want to stop. And thanks to Rishi Sunak, who's now at the top of the house, who was openly pro-crypto before, let's keep pushing that forward. So I've got high hopes for the UK in the coming months to become that crypto hub we're all waiting for it to become.
Fantastic. Tim, this has been a very rich and widely varied discussion. Very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.